Good morning, everyone. We're reading in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, and Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. Sri Aurobindo is sharing with us the very important greater knowledge which lies at the base of this wonderful work. And I believe that last week we read to page 55 and stopped at the break. Yes? So we read Sri Aurobindo's wonderful assurance that when darkness deepens, strangling the earth's breast, and man's corporeal mind is the only lamp, as a thief's in the night shall be the covert tread of one who steps unseen into his house. The transcendent secretly will pervade the material world and take possession of it. The truth light will capture nature by surprise, and earth grow unexpectedly divine. But again, having given us this wonderful assurance, he's going to explore our present situation. What is the present situation of the earth? Patty, will you begin?
A consciousness that knows not its own truth. A vagrant hunter of misleading dawns, between the beam's dark and luminous ends, moves here in a half-light that seems the whole. An interregnum in reality cuts off the integral thought, the total power. It circles or stands in a vague interspace, doubtful of its beginning and its close, or runs upon a road that has no end, far from the original dust, the final flame, in some huge void in conscience it lives, like a thought persisting in a wide emptiness.
Do we still have to read this whole section? We have to read the whole section. Yes, please continue a bit further, Pat. We read. Okay, then we can stop here. Thanks, Patty.
Want me to read more?
Yes, you can read a little bit more.
As if an unintelligible phrase suggested a million renderings to the mind, it lends a purport to a random world, a conjecture leaning upon doubtful proofs, a message misunderstood, a thought confused, missing its aim is all that it can speak, or a fragment of the universal word. It leaves two giant letters void of sense, while without sanction turns the middle sign, carrying an enigmatic universe, as if a present without future or past, repeating the same revolution's whirl, turned on its axis in its own inane.
Yes, let's have a closer look at this symbolic language here. This is an evocation, we can say, of the present consciousness of the material universe. There is a consciousness here, but it's a consciousness that doesn't know its own truth. It's hunting for light. That consciousness is a hunter, but he's a vagrant hunter. A wandering hunter, and he follows misleading dawns, gleams of light that seem to promise a greater day, but no, they are misleading. That's the consciousness that's moving here. This is the consciousness we participate in. It's moving here between the dark and the luminous ends of existence. We're not completely in the dark. We've left some, the inconscience, somewhere behind us, but the greater light is still to come. But this half-light of ignorance that we are moving in now seems to us the whole, as if there can't be anything else. And it's like this because there's an interregnum in reality. An interregnum is the period between two reigns, between two rulers. In Tibet, it used to happen that one Dalai Lama would leave the body, and it would be some time before the new one would be found to take his place. There would be an interregnum, and during that time there would be a regent, somebody appointed to take care of the government. Or it can happen between the death of one king and the installation of another one. So it's as if in the omnipresent reality where we are, in this consciousness we are moving in, there's a kind of gap when we don't know who is the ruler, what is the ruler of this consciousness. And because there's that gap, we are cut off from the integral thought, the total power. Our existence is a partial one. This consciousness seems to be going round in circles, or maybe not moving at all, in a vague interspace, an in-between place or state. It doesn't know, it's doubtful about its beginning. It doesn't know where it has come from, where it has originated, and it doesn't know where its end will be. It feels very, very far from the original dusk, that shadowy state of the beginning, and very far from the final flame, the final revelation in its full intensity. This universe is living in some huge void in conscience, a great emptiness. He says it's like a thought that's persisting, it's continuing to exist in this vast emptiness. And he says it's like a phrase. We hear part of a sentence. It's unintelligible. We can't understand this state that we are in. But it's like a phrase that suggests many possible interpretations. It suggests a million readings to the mind. And we can choose which meaning we want to give us a purport, a meaning, a significance in this random world. Or it's like a guess, a conjecture, a theory, but the proofs for this theory are very doubtful. They're not very, very convincing. Or it's a message, but we haven't understood or we can't understand the message. It's a thought, but the expression of that thought is confused. It misses its aim. It doesn't reach the point that it is aiming at. So that is all that this consciousness can speak and can express. Or he says, it's like a fragment, a part of the universal word, the Om. The Om has, we are told, four syllables, no, but three. Ah, U, M. Yes. So it's as if this world that we are part of represents only one of those syllables, a fragment of the universal word. It leaves two giant letters void of sense, without meaning, because one of them is missing. We don't have the whole word. And the middle sign, the one in the middle, is turning, turning and turning, carrying this enigmatic universe, this universe that's full of mystery, which we cannot understand. It's as if we're living in a present that has no future and no past. It just keeps going round and round and round, turning on its axis like our Earth. The universe is turning in its own inane, its own meaninglessness, its own soullessness, we can say, because this last syllable, ein, it has to do with anima, with the soul. Something that is inane, it's something stupid that has no sense and no essence. That's the consciousness that we seem to be living in, that's moving here in a half light, that seems to us like the whole. Ravi, you'll go on.
Thus is the meaning of creation veiled, for without context reads the cosmic page. Its signs stare at us like an unknown script, as if appeared screened by a foreign tongue, or court of splendor, signs without a key, a portion of a parable sublime. It wears to the perishable creature's eyes the grandeur of a useless miracle, wasting itself that it may last a while, a river that can never find its sea. It runs through life and death on an edge of time. A fire in the night is its mighty action's blaze.
Thank you. So because we are only seeing part of the picture, the meaning of creation is veiled to us. Because we are looking at the universe without context. People often write to me or ask me the meaning of phrases in Savitri. And in order to be able to say something about a simple phrase like that, I have to find the context. Even with a single word, it may have many different meanings, depending on the context, where it appears, what is the rest of the sentence, the rest of the paragraph, the rest of the chapter. So the signs that the universe is presenting to us all the time, they're staring at us. It's like an unknown script, like Egyptian hieroglyphs or Chinese ideograms, some kind of writing that we don't know how to read. It's as if in a foreign language, disguised by a foreign tongue or by a code which has been deliberately has translated the meaning into a code of splendor signs, wonderful, beautiful, amazing signs. But there's no key to that code, or we don't find the key. And in any case, what it's showing us is only part of a story, part of a parable sublime. A parable is a kind of symbolic story, a short, simple story that conveys some deeper truth. So this wonderful universe, when we perishable creatures look at it, it seems so grand, so amazingly huge and magnificent, that it's like a miracle, but a miracle without a meaning, a useless miracle. So far as we can see, it is wasting itself, spending its energy, so that it can last for a short time or a certain time. One of the laws of matter seems to be entropy, that things are gradually running down. It seems like a river meandering here and there, but never reaching the sea, which would be its fulfillment and its purpose. It's running through what we experience as the process of life and death, just on this thin edge of time. And all this energy, all these splendor signs seem to be just like a fire in the night, in a darkness where nothing can be seen except this light of the suns and the stars. So what is to be done, Poonam?
This is our deepest need, to join once more what now is parted, opposite and twin, remote in sovereign spheres that never meet, or fronting like far poles of night and day. We must fill the immense lacuna we have made, rewed the closed finite's lonely consonant with the open vowels of infinity. A hyphen must connect matter and mind, the narrow isthmus of ascending souls. We must renew the secret bond in things. Our hearts recall the lost divine idea, reconstitute the perfect world, unite the Alpha and the Omega in one sound. Then shall the spirit and nature be at one.
Thank you. This is our deepest need, to join once more these things that have been separated or seem to us parted, opposite, opposing and contradictory, twain, divided in two. They seem to be far away from each other, in sovereign spheres, each one complete in itself, and they never meet. Or they are like opposite poles which can never meet, night and day. What we need to do is to fill this immense lacuna, this gap, this hole that we have made. We have to re-wed, to reunite the closed, finite, lonely consonant with the open vowels of infinity. A consonant is a sound that we can express by closing somewhere, closing our lips, or closing the tongue against the teeth, or closing something in the throat. And the vowels, the A and the E and the O and the U, these are open, they are not closed. So in the universal word, there are two vowels and there's one consonant, which seems to represent the finite world, the world of matter, of forms. So these three have to be joined together again. On another way of looking at it, matter is at one extreme, and matter and mind, representing consciousness, is at another. And they need to be connected by a hyphen. A hyphen is that little sign that we put between two words to join them together. Saturday night, we can join them together with a hyphen. And he says that hyphen is like an isthmus. An isthmus is a Greek word for a little neck of land connecting two bigger parts. And very often in our world, like that happens in Panama or in Greece and Corinth, or where Africa joins Asia, and we've cut through the Suez Canal. Very often there's a canal cutting through the isthmus. You know? But he says that isthmus, that narrow connection, is actually the path of the ascending soul, the soul growing and developing in the world of matter to mind and higher levels. That forms the hyphen. Our greatest need is to renew the secret bond in things that connects all reality. Our hearts need to recall, to remember the lost divine idea behind this manifestation. There's one plan. We read it last week, I think. No? So what is the idea behind that? If we were carrying that in our hearts, we'd be able to put together this word, this perfect word again, to unite the Alpha and the Omega in one sound. Alpha is the first letter of the Greek alphabet, and Omega is the last one. So these two words together symbolize the beginning and the end. But here he's saying they have to be joined by a middle sound. If we could create this hyphen of the ascending soul, if we could bring together the vowels and the consonant, then spirit and nature shall be at one, in accord and in harmony, no longer parted, opposite, and twain, as if they could never be one. So now he's going to tell us about the extremes, the spirit and nature. Yes. Yes, hyphen there, yes. Yes. And what forms that hyphen? For us, it's the growth, the development of the soul. As the soul grows more complete in form and in consciousness, and then it creates that connection between the world of matter and the world of spirit. Audrey was asking about it last time. How do we make that connection? And I think in these next sections, Shobindo's going to show us how, what is that connection, how we can recognize it, how we can live with it. Arsu, will you read? Thank you. So the mysterious plan of which all this is a part seems to have two ends, two extremes. And first, he's going to describe for us the spirit's bare and absolute potencies, the powers of the spirit, which dwell in this wide, signless ether of the self, beyond form, in pure existence, in this unchanging silence, which is white, integral, pure, complete, and empty, nude, undisguised in any way. Aloof, they seem separated from everything that we know. They're resplendent, glorious, shining like gold dazzling suns, and we can't see them because they're veiled by the ray of their own light, which our mortal eyes can't bear to look at. It is so bright and dazzling. The spirit's bare and absolute potencies burn in the solitude of the thoughts of God. They are in bliss, a rapture, and a radiance, and a hush, a silence. And our wounded hearts can't reach them. They are delivered from the approach of wounded hearts. They're in another realm where we can't reach them. Our consciousness, our idea, or the idea of our universe that looks at grief and suffering can't enter there. They are very far away from the earth force, the conscious force that suffers, that cries out in its pain. Those bare and absolute potencies are living in the inalienable bliss of God. They are immaculate, absolutely pure and perfect in self-knowledge and self-power. And they are based on, they are at rest, at ease, based on the eternal will. Absolutely calmly, that's their basis. They only have to obey His law. That's the only thing that matters for them. They have no goal to reach. They have no aim which they have to work for or serve. So in every way, they seem to be completely different from us and out of touch with us. Back to you, will you read? Thank you. Implacable is usually a negative word. We often find Schaubinder using such pejorative terms, but with a different nuance of meaning. He says that these bare and absolute potencies of the spirit are implacable, uncompromising, unbending. Even without mercy, they are not going to soften at all. They are implacable in their timeless purity. They are just absolutely what they are, and they won't, there's no flexibility there. So when we try to worship them, they refuse. They don't want our bargaining, our attempts to bribe the Lord. If you do this, then I will serve you and believe in you and worship you. No. They're not affected at all by our cries of revolt or our ignorant prayers. They are not reckoning our virtue and our sin, our good deeds and our bad deeds. They don't care about that at all. No? They are not bending down to listen to the voices that are imploring, begging for divine grace. They hold no traffic. They have no commerce, no connection, no interchange with error, this world of error, of mistakes, of trial and error, error and its reign. Their task is to be guardians of the silence of the truth. They keep the truth pure and unmixed. They are keepers of the immutable decree, that command which has gone out from the beginning and which cannot be changed. The source of their strength is a deep surrender to the will of the eternal. And their way of knowing is through silent oneness with the will of the eternal. Their action is motionless. They act without moving, as if in a state of sleep. They watch all this trouble going on here beneath the stars. It refers to an ancient Greek idea that the earth is at the center of the universe, and then there's the sphere of the moon, and the sphere of the sun, and the sphere of the planets, and the sphere of the stars. And all those higher worlds are perfect. It's only here, in these spheres below the stars, below the moon, the sublunary sphere, there's all this trouble. So they are far above, just watching the trouble beneath the stars. They are deathless, but they do watch what's happening here, the works of death and chance in our material universe. They don't move. They just see all the thousands of years and millions of years passing. They don't feel any emotion. They are untouched, while the long map of fate unrolls through time. What has been determined at the beginning will get fulfilled in time as the map unrolls. They are looking on our struggle with impartial eyes. They don't judge this or that, or prefer this or that. They're completely above it all. And yet, says Sri Aurobindo, without them, cosmos could not be. This cosmos could not exist without those powers watching and supporting it. These are the powers, the spirits. There are these two ends of the mysterious plan, and at one end, what he's describing now, are the spirits, bare and absolute potences. They're on line 398. Those are what is burning, and they are the they and they and they and they in this whole passage. The powers of the spirit. Without them, cosmos could not be. They are one end of the plan. Our difficulty, he says, is to reconcile the two ends, no? But he's showing us the extremes. But now he's telling us about the bare and absolute potencies. Yes?
This is the self, which you describe.
Sorry?
This is the self, sort of far away self, what he is describing. So when we say in the mind,
yes, we could say.
The state of the self, so
yes.
Perhaps
our human way of expressing it is the transcendent, or we can say Satchidananda. That's the highest level that we can conceive with its pure existence, total consciousness and force, total bliss. And there are powers, the powers of the spirit, of the complete oneness. Murat, will you read? Would you read? Top of page 58.
Impervious to desire and gloom and hope, their station of inviolable might, moonless upholds the world's enormous trust. Its ignorance is by their knowledge lit. Its yearnings last by their difference. As the height grows the low forward climb, as the breath drove the small adventure last, their aloofness drives men to surpass himself. Our passion heaves to wed the eternal crown. Our dwarf search mind to meet the omniscient light. Our helpless heart to enshrine the omnipotent force. Acquaintance in the wisdom that they have. And the harsh utility of death and tears, acquiescence in the gradual steps of time, careless they seem of the grief that stings the world's heart, careless of the pain that rends its body in life. Above joy and sorrow is that grandeur of walk. They have no portion the good that dies. Mute, pure, they share not in the evil one, else might their strength be marred and not saved.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So that's these absolute powers. This is how they are upholding the cosmos. They are impervious. Desire and doom and hope can't penetrate them at all. There they are, they have a place, a station, a level where they are unmoving, and their power is inviolable. It can't be weakened or attacked in any way. There they are, moveless. Without moving, they are upholding the world's enormous task. They're supporting all this struggle and growth and trouble beneath the stars. The ignorance of our world is lit by their knowledge. Some of their light comes here. And our yearning, our longing for a better state is supported, encouraged by their indifference, the fact that they are impartial and that they are not troubled. It allows them to go on supporting all this. He says, the height draws the low ever to climb. The fact that the heights are there inspires us to climb them. When people were asked, Why do you want to climb Mount Everest? Because it is there. So, our recognition that, yes, there are greater heights of consciousness, that gives us inspiration not to be content with our ignorant state. No? As the breadths open wide spaces, draw the small to adventure vast. We may stand on a seashore and look out and wonder what is on the other side. And that wondering has inspired all the exploration that has gone on until now we can see our Earth from outer space. And there's so many more spaces calling us to adventure vast. Well, you have to take risks on a journey. That's why it's an adventure. Yes, of course. And there's something in us which loves adventure. No? Just going on a journey might not be so interesting, but if it's an adventure, yeah, there's an attraction about it. So in a similar way, the fact that they are so beyond our reach drives man to surpass himself. Nietzsche said, and Sri Aurobindo quoted him as saying, that the destiny of man is to surpass himself, to exceed himself. That is the destiny of all of us. We are attracted by those higher possibilities. So like a sea being attracted, an ocean being attracted by the gravity pull of the moon, our passion, our intense feeling reaches up to try to connect with that calm of the eternal. And our tiny little mind, our dwarf search mind, aspires to reach the light of the all-knowing, the omniscient. Our weak and helpless hearts aspire to become shrines for the force of the all-powerful. Those pure and absolute powers, they are acquiescing in the wisdom that made hell. To acquiesce, it means to say yes to. It's very difficult for us to say yes to the wisdom that made hell, those dreadful states of apparently eternal suffering. They are not really places of eternal suffering, but while you are there, it feels like that. They are acquiescing in the harsh utility, the usefulness of death and tears. They are acquiescing, they are saying yes to the gradual steps of time, the fact that all this takes such a long time to unfold. So when we see that they are saying yes to all that, we think that they don't care about us. They seem to be careless to all this grief that's stinging the world's heart. They seem to not care at all about all the pain that tears the body and life of Earth existence. They are walking calmly there, above joy and sorrow. They have no share at all in the good things that die, that vanish. They are silent, they are pure, they don't share at all in the evil that happens here on Earth, because if they did, their strength to help us might be marred, might be damaged and spoiled, and wouldn't be able to save us. That's why they are there, these bare and absolute potencies. But that's not the end of the story. Yes.
Something to learn a little bit of this way, how they are acting or the
Yes, I think these lines are showing us a very profound truth that's not very accessible to us normally. We can accuse God and say, you don't care. We've seen these terrible things on the news about old ladies in Syria lifting their fists to heaven and saying, Allah, Allah, why aren't you taking care of us? No, we can't understand this aspect of the Supreme. So here Sri Aurobindo is showing us that this is one aspect of the Spirit's power to uphold impartially all this and to attract all this to higher consciousness, to higher levels, by a kind of spiritual magnetism.
Why do they not save us? Why they not?
They do save us. He will explain that next. But they save us in this way which we can't understand easily with our human hearts and our minds. So he's going to tell us that it's not the end of the story. Let's read a little further.
When you tell you don't understand, it's true, something after 15 August my life changed. I don't understand, but I don't fight with the divine. I don't cry, I don't, but when I stay, I accept totally. Suddenly emerge something, but not in the mind. Suddenly coming exactly what I do or what
yes.
I do. Exactly.
So that's the equality that Margaret is talking yeah. about. If we
it's
can achieve that.
For me, yeah, it's a little experience, but it's very, very in the mind, in the vital, and in the physical. It's very
So that means something of the calm of those absolute potences.
Yes.
You have felt it. Yes, it's very important. Would you like to read? Yes. Thank you. So those immortal beings doesn't see things the way that we see them, because they are alive, intimately, constantly aware of the truth that dwells in God's extremes, in the opposites, in the contradictions, apparent contradictions. The immortal is awake to this movement, constant, ongoing movement of all-seeing force, of a consciousness, a conscious force that acts with knowledge. He's aware that through the long, ambiguous years that are so difficult to understand what's going on, there's an outcome gradually being prepared and realized. And that very often means that out of woeful deeds, terrible things that we think should never have happened, some good is going to come. The immortal being is looking on things that are hidden to us, hidden aspects, screened, disguised powers, and he knows the law and natural line of things, the true law which is governing the movement of this universe. We have only a very brief life, and that makes us impatient. We feel driven to act, and we want to see fulfillment of our actions. It's very frustrating if we can't see the fulfillment. And we are driven by pity and by fear, but the immortal doesn't feel that. So he is in no hurry, those immortal beings are in no hurry to untie this puzzling knot of the universe. He sees the world's jarring heart, this heart that is full of conflict and suffering. Jarring is that when things don't go together comfortably, there's a clash. It's like when the door is just a little bit open and there's a breeze and it comes and it bangs it and it bangs again and it bangs again. It's so irritating, this jarring. And we know the door shouldn't be jarring, it should be closed or open. The heart is like that. There's all this jarring going on, painful shocks coming. But he's in no hurry to set that right. He's waiting in time for the hour of the eternal, for the moment when the masked transcendent mounts his throne and earth grows unexpectedly divine. But Sri Aurobindo gives us the assurance that despite all that and apparent indifference of the spirit's powers, yet a spiritual secret aid is there. There is a help and a support. Evolution winds on tardily, so slowly. It takes so long because nature has to hew her way, cut her way, as if through rock or through a dense forest, through adamant. Actually, adamant is diamond. It's the hardest substance. While all that's going on, there is a divine power of intervention, of help, seated, enthroned above. Lorraine.
Alive and dead, rotating universe, we whirl not here upon a causal globe, abandoned to a task beyond our force. Even through the tangled anarchy called fate, and through the bitterness of death and fall, an outstretched hand is felt upon our lives. It is near us in numbered bodies and births, in its unslackening grasp, it keeps for us safe. The one inevitable supreme result, no will can take away, and no doom change. The crown of consciousness, immortality, the Godhead promised to our struggling souls, when first man's heart dared death and suffered life.
Thank you. So whatever may be the appearances, we alive here on this apparently dead, or in this universe where there's no life, we're not whirling here upon a casual globe that's just here accidentally. We've not been abandoned to a task that's beyond our strength. So even through all this tangled anarchy. Anarchy is when there seems to be no rule, no government, no leadership, no? When everything is so confused and mixed up. No? Even through the bitterness of death, and fall, the sense of having fallen below our true selves. In spite of all that, we can feel an outstretched hand upon our lives, that divine intervention. And Sri Aurobindo assures us that that hand is near us in unnumbered bodies and births, and it's holding on tight to something. In its unslackening grasp, it keeps for us safe the one inevitable, supreme result no will can take away and no doom change, the crown of conscious immortality, the Godhead promised to our struggling souls when first man's heart dared death and suffered life. We were given a choice. Nobody put us here just arbitrarily like that. We were offered the opportunity, the possibility of participating in this evolving universe, in this material world, with all the consequences of that, this adventure of unconsciousness. But when we were offered the choice, we were also promised something. We were promised the crown of conscious immortality. The soul may accept to be involved in matter, in total unconsciousness. And perhaps at that moment of total involvement, it looks impossible that any evolution is possible, can come about. It's such an enormous challenge if we become identified with sea and sky and stone. How are we going to become divine beings, free, conscious, but it's been promised to our souls, along with this, all the struggle of the process. And we human beings, every one of us, has accepted. We've dared to face the danger of death, the suffering of life.
And also promises to help and be with us.
Yes, and that hand is always near us. It has been from the very beginning, and it always will be, and it's keeping safe for us.
So there is no risk. There is no risk.
Yes, but ultimately there's no risk, no. But we've agreed to go through the whole process, which does involve some risk, even to our souls, as we shall see as we go on reading the poem. But yes, the one inevitable result we are promised, it will come about through all the adventure, whatever we have to face.
That means the risk is an apparent. The risk is an apparent risk, it is not real.
Otherwise it wouldn't be an adventure.
Perceiving risk.
It's a perceived risk, yes. Yeah.
So,
but there are some dangers on the way, yes, for sure. And if we only face them with our own surface strength, we may have to pass through some hard experiences.
I read a prayer of the mother that sums this up the other day. It's August 31st, 1914. It was written around the time of the start of the First World War.
Yes.
So the final lines are, peace, peace upon all the earth. War is an appearance. Turmoil is an illusion. There's only immutable peace. So if we can cling to that peace, then we can go through all the vicissitudes. And
right.
That's where the faith is required.
Yes. And so Sri Aurobindo is giving us a wonderfully convincing and coherent support to our faith. The faith is the soul's response to the knowledge that's given. Rosa, will you read?
Mm-hmm.
I want to read the next sentence. Rosa.
Sins and sorrows and our tears. His knowledge overrules our nescience. Whatever their appearance, we must hear. Whatever our strong ills and present pain, when nothing we can see,
Baal. Guidance, a mighty guidance. So this is what we should remember. Whatever the strong appearance we must bear, a mighty leads us still through all. One who has shaped this world is ever its Lord. He's still in charge. He's always in charge. And our errors are his steps upon the way.
Somewhere it is said, the souls that cannot aspire is God's failure.
That's one of Shobindo's aphorisms. Yeah. Challenging us to think or to feel more deeply. So let's hear Mother reading some of these passages.
In battle shall we let the spirits grow. A few shall see what nothing yet understand. God shall go up while the wise men talk and sleep. For man shall not know the coming.
Thanks to Shobindo.